Hi, I'm Dawson Church, your host for the Tapping Peak Performance Series. I am so excited to share these breakthrough programs with you, and I look forward to powerful shifts in your level of personal performance as a result. By listening to this program, you agree to all the terms of the disclaimer, which you can find at disclaimer.eftuniverse.com. Now let's explore the next insightful topic in the series together. Jack Canfield is the co-author of the number one New York Times best-selling series, Chicken Soup for the Soul, which has sold an astonishing over 115 million copies in 47 languages. Known as America's number one success coach, he is also of the inspiring book, The Success Principles, the book The Power of Focus, and other books. Jack is a featured teacher in the movies The Secret and Tapping the Source, and has appeared on more than 1,000 radio and TV programs, including The Oprah Winfrey Show, Montel, Larry King Live, and The Today Show. Jack is the CEO of the Canfield Training Group and the founder of the Transformational Leadership Council. I am so pleased and privileged, Jack, to have you here today. Thank you. Your book, The Success Principles, has the distinction of being the most stolen title in my house. My wife loaned it out to her sister. She never brought it back. I bought another copy, got loaned to another friend, never came back. And I think I'm on my third or fourth copy at this point. And I just love the way that people get so much out of this book. You interviewed all of these successful people, and then you distilled their wisdom into these 64 timeless principles. I so want to hear your take both on those principles and also the process he went through undertaking this enormous task. So first of all, just one principle. The first principle you have there is taking 100% responsibility. Why did you choose to make that the very first principle you discussed?
Well, I'll answer that, but let me just vamp for 1 minute on the idea that it took a long time to put this book together. It took me 14 months, Dawson, to write this book, which included 40 years of my experience. I've read over 3,000 books, taken hundreds, literally hundreds of multi-day seminars, countless videos and video trainings. And then I interviewed 75 of the world's most successful people. I mean, people in all walks of life, generals in the military, people that have gold, you know, Grammy record awards and things like that. And really, I wrote over 1,000 pages. My editor went nuts. I had to take it down to 440 pages. But the reason I put the 100% responsibility first is this. It is literally the most foundational of all the principles, because if you don't take 100% responsibility, it means you believe that outside forces are controlling your life. And I really want people to get that they are the cause of their conditions, that all of the conditions you currently experience in your life, both internally and externally, your health, your wealth, your friendships, your intimacy, your great relationships or not, how much money you have, the impact you have in the world, all of that is based on the thoughts you thought, the images you imagined, the actions you took, and the things you said or didn't say in the past. And so when people really get that I am 100% responsible for my life, then they realize if I created it, I can uncreate it and recreate it the way I want to. Otherwise, you believe that it's your parents or society or the government or the weather or your genetics or whatever that's controlling you. And there's no question that those things don't have an influence. But we've all seen people that have lost limbs. We've seen people that have, you know, grown up in the worst of situations, twins where one becomes a success and the other's a failure. So we know that it's not the outer conditions that control you. It's how you respond to them. And as you may remember in my book, there's a formula that says E plus R equals O. Event plus response equals outcome. And basically, if you don't like your outcomes, quit blaming the events in your life, the external events, and start changing your responses. Because like a mathematical formula, 2 plus 2 equals 4. Event plus your response equals 4. If you don't like 4 and you want 5, call better health, better relationships, more money, etc., you have to up your game to do 3 instead of 2. And sometimes the universe does a 1 instead of a 2, like you have a recession, there's a hurricane, you know, some new business comes along and wipes out your business like Apple did with certain other companies. Now you've got to also up your game to even have it as good as you had it before, let alone better. So basically, I really want people to get that I am responsible. Now, one final thing on this is that I don't know for sure that we're 100% responsible. We might be only 95% or even 70%. But here's the point. If you act as if you are 100% responsible for everything that happens in your life transforms. You know, in my relationship, if my wife's upset, there could be a lot of things going on there. But if I say to myself, what did I do to cause her to be that way? Then at least I'm looking. And if I do find something, I can change it. I can't change what I'm not aware of. And if I don't look, I don't expand my awareness.
Wow. So it's a starting point for change, even if it's not literally true. And again, I find that some people, when you mention this to them, maybe one of the reasons I had your book out, Jack, is I'm afraid to attract the anger of people, maybe having adverse circumstances, and then be saying, oh, well, how can this happen to me because of whatever it was out there? You realize after they've done it like 4 times, 5 times, 9 times, 12 times, that it is them. But it is for people going through those hurricanes, those disasters, those. You know, the unemployment, whatever, it is a hard pill to swallow. And how do you respond to people like that?
Well, I say, look, you know, obviously if I'm living in California where the weather's sunny and you're in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina's happening, you're dealing with a much more intense E than I am, a much more intense event. But the fact is, the people that got hurt down there were the people that didn't move, the people that didn't leave. They had what I call yellow alerts. People were saying, hey, there's a hurricane coming. And a lot of people didn't leave. They didn't take their best possessions with them. They know they live in an area where the levees and the dikes are not good. If you live in Hurricane Alley or you live in Tornado Alley in Oklahoma and places like that, it's don't be surprised when you have a hurricane. Don't be surprised when there's an earthquake in California. You know, I remember we had an earthquake Northridge.
Yeah.
And I lived in LA at the time. And, you know, fortunately, we had done all the things you're supposed to do. We had, you know, screwed our bookcases to the wall. We had a chain holding the TV in the back, you know, to the wall. Because I remember when I came out, the TV was hanging off the wall. It would have, like, shot across the room and beheaded someone if it didn't happen during the day. So, and we knew that was an issue. And so we did all the precautions to do that. And a lot of people don't take those precautions. They don't pay attention because it's inconvenient. You know, we always say that there's clues. I remember growing up in West Virginia where the main livelihood around where I was steel mills and coal mines. And, you know, there was a big clarity that oil was going to replace coal, but no one was listening. No one wanted to go back to school and get retrained. So when it happened, everyone like was quote unquote caught off guard. But the fact is they had their heads in the sand. So the reality is we have choices. You know, we can move. We can get different education. We can, you know, bolt our house to the foundation, et cetera. So, yes, there are certain conditions that are difficult. But, you know, people will say often like, well, I didn't create my cancer. And I'll say things like, well, did you eat a totally organic diet? Did you cleanse on a regular basis? Do you wear any kind of EMF protection? Do you keep your cell phone on your body? Do you live next to a high energy transformer? You know, blah, blah, blah. We can go down the road. Have you forgiven everyone in your past? Because we know that cancer often comes along with lack of forgiveness. So basically people go, well, I didn't know about that. Well, whose responsibility is it to educate yourself about your health, about your wealth, and about your relationships? It's ultimately yours.
It's far easier to project the responsibility out there and make someone else wrong. And the irony is, though, that you don't have the capacity to change until you bring the power back into yourself.
Right.
One of my favorite sayings is by Carl Rogers, the great client-centered therapist of the 20th century. He said that the paradox of change is that the journey of change starts with accepting things the way they are. And
yes.
Then when you do that and then accept that you are that mover, then you stop placing the power outside of yourself and trying to manipulate people and events outside of yourself. And instead, you realize you have the power and you fully empower yourself. And that is the place to begin.
Yes, I had the good fortune to actually co-lead a two-day workshop with Carl Rogers, and he was an amazing being. And the idea of first accepting things the way they are, you have to be realistic. You know, my book title is The Success Principles, How to Get from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. You can't get from where you want to be, where you are to where you want to be if you don't know where you are. If a GPS system working in your car, all you have to do is put in the destination, but it has to know from the satellite where you currently are, or it can't give you direction. So being open and honest and realistic about what you're currently dealing with is important, but it is also important that you realize that you ultimately have the power to change your life.
Yes. Now, one of the puzzling things to me about the book, too, is that that's the first question. The last section of the book, next to the last section of the book, is where you put money. So rather than money being way up front, money is the next to last section in the book. I'm just curious as to why you put it there rather than front and center.
Well, a couple of reasons. I mean, money is obviously very important. I forget who said it, but someone said money's like oxygen. Try to live without either one. You won't live very long. So money is really critical. However, what I wanted to do was not just focus on money, but focus on all the areas of our life, because money alone is just a vehicle to buy the other things that allow you to have good health, good relationships, comfortable home, you know, travel, education, etc. And so there are certain fundamentals in the book. In fact, the first 25 chapters are all what I call the fundamentals, and those apply to everything. And so we put money in the back because we knew people would want to be wealthier. I mean, most people, if you come to a seminar and you ask them, what are the three things you want? If you could snap your fingers and get three things you want in your life, it's always a relationship goal, a money goal, and a health goal. You know, they want to be thinner, they want to be richer, and they would like to have more friends or be closer or be married or, you know, whatever. So money's important. But if you remember, in the second chapter of the book, or it's actually chapter three called Decide What You Want, we take people through a vision exercise, and there's seven areas of your life we focus on, and money is number one, financial, and then relationships, job and career, health and fitness, what we call personal, which is possessions and spiritual growth and so forth, and finally community and philanthropy. And so it does actually show up sooner than you think. But if you don't have 100% responsibility, clarity about your purpose, know what your vision is that you want to produce in your life, get your beliefs clear, set goals, which can include money, have action plans, know how to do affirmations and visualization, know how to take action by overcoming fear, ask for what you want, reject rejection, get feedback, persist, don't give up, get motivated and stay motivated, manage time, etc. All those things are prerequisite to any goal, including money. So the first part of the book really focuses on, doesn't matter if you're want to improve your golf game, become a best-selling author, make more money, end hunger in the world. All of those principles are universal. And so we wanted to do the universality first and then focus on specifics later in the book.
That makes sense, because if you master those first principles, then all the other parts of your life maybe don't fall magically into place perfectly at the beginning, but at least you then start to both maximize your strengths and also address your weaknesses. And it's important to do both those things at the same time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So share one of your personal Jack Canfield breakthroughs or shifts or struggles or challenges that was a real transition point for you with money.
Well, you know, I grew up in a very poor family. We were on the bottom end of lower class and the top end of poor. And I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship because I did well in school to go to Harvard, where I majored in Chinese history, which has prepared me to do this work today.
Oh, it's perfect A to B progression. I see that now. Yeah.
Yes, obviously. That was my senior year. I took an elective class in psychology, and that's when I fell in love with all this human potential stuff. But my dad was a person who, we had a florist, and he sold flowers to the rich people. And he always felt like the rich people ripped everyone else off, and if I became rich, I was going to be one of the bad guys, kind of a union mentality. Then my first career was as a high school teacher. I made $8,000 a year. I didn't think that was very much money, but last night, just because I was getting ready for this interview, I thought, what's that worth in today's inflation money, you know? And literally, that's $48,000 worth of buying power today, so I wasn't as bad off, I guess, as I thought I was. But I rented an apartment for $79 a week. And then I went to work for W. Clement Stone, who had a foundation, and he challenged me to set a goal that was so big that if I achieved it, it would only be because he said that I could do it. And I literally started having affirmations that God is my unlimited supply and large sum of money comes to me. Some of the money comes to me quickly and easily. And I also had affirmations like, you know, I deserve money, I'm a money magnet, you know, all the normal things. And I began to overcome those limiting beliefs in my childhood. And that first year when I did all that, I made $92,000, $93,000. It was pretty cool. But my favorite story is when I was working, how long is this ago? About 10 years ago, I was down in Dallas, Texas, And a friend of mine said, you should go see this guy named John DeVore. I said, why? He said, he's a magician. He does this amazing transpersonal, transformational work. So I said, okay. So I went to see him, and he said, what's your presenting issue? What do you want to work on? I said, well, I don't really have one. My friend said, you know, I should come see you. And he said, well, do you have anything you want more of in your life? I said, well, yeah, I'd like more money. And he said, well, how much do you want? I said, well, I've had this goal. I want to make $8 million in 1 year, and I can't get my staff enrolled in this vision where they can hold it. And he said, well, let's muscle test you. So he muscle tested me, and we got up to about $3 million, which is what I was making, maybe five, something like that. And my arm went weak. And he said, no, it's not them, it's you. And I said, really? So we did this amazing work. It's kind of like tapping, but it's a little different. He did all. I'm looking through different color lenses and glasses while he's doing tuning forks and changing my vibration and all that. And by the end, we're testing my arm for $8 million, $100 million, all the money in the world. No one else gets anything. And I was strong. And so I came back, and that next year, we sold one of my companies for over $60 million. And it was like, whoa. And so that was like a shift for me. And I think the value of that story is this, to the average person listening out there, is that you think that the world's not treating you right, or you're not making enough money, or you deserve more, or everything you're doing, you feel frustrated. But the truth is, there's always a limiting belief that's hanging out inside, or some competing intention. You know, like if I make money, I won't be spiritual, or my friends will, I won't know who my real friends are, or whatever. And when you clear that through any number of techniques, tapping, of which, you know, you're involved with, and I do as well, is one of the most powerful ones, then it opens up, and the floodgates can allow a lot more abundance in.
So you initially, you were a high school teacher. You then were saying these affirmations to overcome limiting beliefs, mm-hmm. and you were able to literally increase your income tenfold. What about people when they say those affirmations, when they try and overcome those limiting beliefs? Those objections to success that pop up are so strong and so compelling that they actually carry more emotional weight than the affirmation. What would you do in that case?
Well, then you have to tap on that belief. You have to, in other words, my whole, when I learned to do affirmations was from a woman named Sandra Ray. And her technique was to take a piece of paper and fold it half long ways like we used to do for spelling tests in school. And then on the left-hand side, write your affirmation. And on the right-hand side, any limiting belief or thought, or, you know, you're crazy, that'll never happen, you're a black woman in the South and you've got all these things against you, whatever it is, when that comes up, write that in the right-hand column. And then go over there and either create an opposite affirmation for that, or now we have better technology, which is we can tap on these limiting beliefs and we can disappear them. So basically, when that emotion comes up, it's just usually from some childhood experience. We can go back and do deeper work like matrix re-imprinting, or we can just do little voice tapping where we tap on the inner critic. We can take the internal coach and the internal critic and turn it into an internal coach. So there's a lot of different technologies that exist within the EFT community that can be used to deal with these emotions and limiting beliefs that come up. And you can go outside the EFT community to Byron Katie, to Sedona Method, to meditation, NLP. I mean, we live in an age, as you know, where there's so much technology, it's just you got to do it. Most people forget to use what they know.
Yeah, and we get trained in an endless, fascinating succession of new techniques, and then often don't implement the very simple ones we've learned initially. So yeah. how do you turn that inner critic into an inner coach?
Well, basically for me, I do two things. Number one, the first thing I do is I say, hey, cut it out. you're supposed to be on my team here. I know you're trying to help me. So you have to realize,
right.
Number one, become aware. Realize that your inner critic is probably the interjection of your parents trying to help you when you were younger, but they ended up constricting you. And so then I go through a process. I have a book called Tapping into Ultimate Success, where we first acknowledge that the coach is on your side. And then we say, look, I know you're trying to help me. So you're having this internal dialogue. And the problem is, what you're doing is you're actually making it worse. So now what I need you to do is to coach me and support me and encourage me. And when I make progress, you know, affirm me, validate me, etc. So we can kind of retrain it. And then we can do some tapping to see if it actually got in there. And then we can try taking an action or thinking a new thought and see what comes up or not until we get clear. But again, you know, there's a 9-step process we talk about in that book that help people walk through that.
Yeah, and that is a real challenge because people, as you're saying, do internalize those. These were parents or teachers or authority figures trying to help us early on, and right. yet they wound up limiting us, and then we have these things firmly installed in our heads, and shifting them and getting them to change can be really, really, really challenging. I know for me, it's one of my biggest challenges. I'll like stand up to give a keynote speech somewhere. I'll give a speech. I'll walk off the stage, and I'll remember the one thing I could have said better.
See, here's what I actually have a technique for that, which is you couldn't have remembered it when you didn't remember it. If you could have, you would have. So now this inner critic coach comes in and says, oh my God, you should have said that, or you should have had a break, or you should have given them an exercise or whatever. And you say, thank you. Next time I will do that. So what I want you to do is acknowledge, because what you're getting is corrective feedback. I don't know if you've ever learned to juggle, Dawson, but I used to teach juggling in my seminars. And what happens is every time I drop the ball, and in fact, we use beanbags because balls bounce away and beanbags stay still, so it's easier to work with. Every time I drop that, my internal mechanism in my brain is noticing, oh, I threw that one a little too far. And so if you go away from that and do nothing but come back the next day, you'll be a little bit better because it's paying attention to where you went off. So I tell my inner critic, thank you very much for the feedback. I will do that next time because I can't do anything about it now. And so is there anything else you'd like to tell me about how I can improve it? It'd be like me sitting in the back of your room because you invited me to say, how can I do it better? It doesn't mean you didn't do it badly because we're all way too critical of ourselves. You know, and sometimes you'll leave out a story and you'll go, oh, I should have said it. But no one in your audience knows that. They didn't look at your outline. So basically, they got a great experience. And my inner critic is simply saying, hey, next time, let's do it this way. And once I train it to speak to me that way, it does.
Interesting. So you actually retrain your inner critic to support you rather than and validating it.
I don't think you can kill off parts of yourself. I do think you can retrain them.
Yeah, and of course, that part of yourself, you try and suppress it or kill it off, it'll just surface in some other way.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, I always say, like when my mother would say to me, I'd run out in front of a car, let's say, and she'd say, oh my God, I can't believe how many times have I told you not to do that? Go up to your room and you think about what you did. Now, my mother said that because she loves me. She doesn't want me to die. But do you think I go up to my room and go, oh, my mom really loves me. That's why she wants me up here. She doesn't want me to die. No, I'm up there going, my mom hates me. She thinks I'm stupid. So we have to go back to what is the original intention. And the original intention of that critic is to keep you safe. But it's keeping you safe in a way that's no longer serving you.
Yeah. So the goal is to retrain it in a way that does serve you rather than, so you can't get rid of it, just retrain it, and then it serves you rather than undercutting you and making you feel bad about your performance.
Absolutely.
Makes sense, yeah. Jack, one thing, as you mentioned, those shifts going to work for W. Clement Stone and then taking all those seminars you took, you've had this progression of careers in your life. And I think it's fascinating the way you've done one thing, then you've gradually, or maybe suddenly, moved out of that thing into a new thing. How do you know when you're on the cusp of one of those shifts?
Well, one of two things happens. Either I get really bored with the old, or something new comes along that just excites me more. And, you know, you're right. I've been a teacher trainer, a therapist. I ran a personal growth center. I was an insight trainer, which is like LifeSpring, Landmark, those big things, for about 3 years. I was a self-esteem trainer, a best-selling author. I've been a motivational speaker, trainer of trainers, product developer, and on I could go. And what's happened every time is normally something comes along. Like I was running this growth center, running gestalt therapy groups, maybe, you know, 30 people on a weekend. And then I took a program called Actualizations with Stuart Emery, and there was like 300 people in the group. And it was this tremendous transformation for everybody. And I went, wow, I want to grow up and do that. That's a lot more exciting. I'm not one-on-one with some neurotic person in a room. This is more interesting. You get more change, more bang for your buck, more impact. So I ended up taking a couple of those trainings, fell in love with one called Insight because it had a spiritual dimension to it. And then I went out, I literally sold my growth center within 3 months. I moved to California and I started working with them. And I did that for a number of years. And then all of a sudden I decided the guy running the program was running a cult behind it. And I didn't want to be a part of a recruiting center for a cult. So I quit. And then I started self-esteem seminars. And then one day someone said, that story you told about a puppy, is that in a book anywhere? And I said, no. The next day someone said, that story about the Girl Scouts, is that in a book anywhere? This happened, I swear, Dawson, for 30 days in a row. Someone said, that story you told in the speech, is that anywhere? And I got this divine inspiration to put all those stories I tell into a book, which became Chicken Soup for the Soul. And that was like, I was like a dog on a bone. I couldn't get it out of my system. And then for 10 years, we rode that, you know, ride, Chicken Soup for the Soul. I think it was 15 years. Then eventually I said we sold the company to another company. And I got bored. I remember one day I'm reading a story that should have been inspiring about a person that, like a one-legged mountain climber to climb Mount Everest. And I just thought, oh, not another stupid one-legged mountain climber.
Yeah, they're all over the place, you know.
I know, I know. And I've used this metaphor. I said it was like a gynecologist who'd seen one too many vaginas. They just didn't interest me anymore. And so, it was boring. So I said, this isn't fun. So I said, what would be fun? I hadn't been doing trainings for a long time. So I said, I'm going to start doing trainings again. And that's what I've been doing now for the last, you know, 6 or 7 years and really loving it. Now we're training trainers. So I say, if I have one successful habit, it's called I listen to my internal states and I honor them as long as they're not coming from some, you know, past trauma. And I follow my inner guidance, you know, both from meditation and from my feeling states. If I'm not experiencing joy, you know, I'm a big believer in what Abraham and Esther Hicks teach, that joy is your inner guidance system. And if I'm not experiencing joy at what I'm doing, like I'm loving talking to you right now, if I get tired of these, I stop doing them. And so it's called pay attention to, am I losing the juice here? Is this no longer exciting for me? Am I no longer joyful doing this? Or is something coming along, it's like more joyful than the thing you've been doing? And then follow your heart, you know, as follow your bliss, as Joseph Campbell said.
Even more joyful. I like that criterion for change.
Yeah.
Wow. That's that. Is. Now, when you are full of passion, when you are in that burst of fresh energy doing a new project, how do you distinguish that kind of energy from when you feel driven? And I ask this, you know, very personally myself. I feel immense energy for many, many projects. If I don't feel energy, I cross them off the list. But then at a certain point, I can get kind of type A obsessive about them as well.
Right.
And that's my signal to slow down. And
sure.
You know, when I maybe tormenting my family with dinner time conversation about them all, every night.
Right.
How do you know the difference between those two kinds of drive?
Well, you know, someone once taught me to pay attention to whether my body was feeling expansive or contracting.
Hmm.
And when I'm feeling excited and passionate and you know, like what we're talking about, I feel expanded. I feel like, you know, my chest, my stomach, there's energy. I feel open. When I'm feeling driven, there's a sense of contraction. My shoulders get tight. My arms come in. I'm kind of like hyperactive, ADD, on speed. And so I can be excited and be speedy, but there's a difference in that kind of adrenaline rush, driven state. And again, I think, you know, you mentioned your family. My wife is a good barometer as well. I mean, she can tell when I'm overamped and when I'm excited and I'm happy. She doesn't mind if I'm working late. But if I'm in that driven state and I'm working late, she feels abandoned. It's really interesting.
Huh. Wow.
You know what I think it is? I think it's because I've abandoned myself.
Huh.
And then she sees that and picks it up on that level.
That is so interesting that she, on some energetic level or some subconscious level, is picking up which of those two motivations is keeping you working late.
Right.
Hmm. Interesting. So she's on some level sensing that same kind of contraction versus expansion.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, there's a woman, I'm forgetting her name right now, she wrote a book called Your Inner Guide System or something like that, but she really helped me realize somewhere between your chin and your groin, there is this either expansive or contractive, an energy flow or an energy block, a numbing out or a feeling of aliveness. And she literally would just say, if you have a decision to make, you could actually go inside and then in your mind make one decision and notice what happens in that area, and then also make the other decision in your mind and visualize that and see what happens in your area, and you usually get a very distinct distinction between those two.
One thing I so enjoy about your approach is you have so many practical exercises like that you can do, and you're always bringing it down to some kind of experiential way of learning. And mm-hmm. I think that is why people do so well in your trainings, is that you're constantly getting it anchored in their bodies and in their feeling states rather than just a mental concept.
Right. No, I really feel like my expertise is in what I call experiential training. So you're right on.
So imagine you're starting a new project and you are excited about that and you feel a sense of contraction, a sense of expansion rather in your body, and you just feel that juice and passion flowing, but there's some element in the task that is still tripping you up. So maybe you have a list of 79 to-dos to make this thing successful, and there's one or there's three of those that you are holding back on. What do you do when you know the overall direction of a project is really in alignment with your guidance and with your overall goals, and yet some elements of it, maybe that one person you don't want to call, that one task you know you can't delegate and has to be done, but you keep putting off?
Well, that happens to me. I'm still human. I mean, I occasionally scare myself. And, you know, it's usually, for me, it's always the fear of looking inadequate or the fear of rejection. Those are my two big ones. And doesn't happen very often, but it does. I remember when I was working on the Success Principles book, I wanted to interview Donald Trump. And this was in 2004. I was writing the book, which came out in 2005. And that's when The Apprentice started. January of 2004 was our first episode. So he was like in everybody's radar. And I thought, God, if I got an interview with him, this would be fabulous for the book. But he was so big at that point and so busy and so forth. I just kept telling myself, no, he'll reject me. And I don't like that feeling. And so I was protecting myself, not even so much from the rejection, but from whatever feeling I hadn't handled, you know, that comes with that. And I put it off and I put it off and I put it off and I put it off. Well, it eventually got to a point where if I don't do it now, I'm not going to do it. And so I teach a little technique called feel the fear and do it anyway. And I have a little mantra I teach people. I have them put their fingers together and chant, oh, what the heck? Oh, for it anyway. And so I did what I teach, and I just picked up the phone and dialed the number that I had gotten from a friend of mine, and turned out he was unavailable and didn't want to do it, which was fine with me. But the big hurdle for me was just doing it, you know, just making the phone call. And what I find is after I made that phone call and I didn't die, I probably called 7 or 8 other people who were in that same level of category I'd been putting off, but they weren't quite Donald Trump. And so even when you fail sometimes, just the fact that you survive the action gives you that momentum or that motivation to move through. I mean, another example in my life was when I got divorced from my ex-wife, which is about 13 years ago. And I had our marriage, it's kind of like your question earlier, how do you know something? Our marriage had fallen, it's gotten really dead. We weren't angry with each other. No one did anything bad. We were just boring. And it's like our color movie had turned to black and white. And I just didn't want to hurt my ex-wife by telling her I didn't want to live with her anymore. And I remember I went through this period of a year where I can't tell her in August because that's my birthday party coming up and that'll ruin that. September's our wedding anniversary, and September 30th is her, you know, birthday, so I don't want to ruin that. October, we had this family reunion we were doing. November, Thanksgiving. Christmas, I couldn't ruin Christmas. January, her mother was coming. February was Valentine's Day. I mean, I went through like 7 months of why it wasn't the right time. And finally, one day I said, you know, this is ridiculous. I'd have to do it. It was so hard, Dawson, so hard. But I did it. And so eventually you just have to realize you're scaring yourself by imagining how bad it's going to be, and start visualizing yourself about how good it's going to be. Brian Tracy once told me, he said, whenever you've done anything you've been putting off for a long time, isn't it true that the next thing you say was, why didn't I do that sooner? And it's so true. And so what I teach people and attempt to live in my own life right now is just remind myself, what's the upside? The bad side is usually just, you know, like for me, getting a rejection. Well, I already have a rejection. I'm rejecting myself by not asking. So the worst it's going to get is not that bad. And then just go ahead and do it.
And then, of course, once you have done it that one time, you then got the neural wiring in your brain for doing it. You've activated the energy of doing it. You've given yourself momentum toward doing it. And all of those things can carry you forward where before they weren't present.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I don't have much trouble asking anybody for anything these days, but I did then. That was very scary. But again, the point I want to make is I was scaring myself by imagining negative outcomes. There was nothing intrinsically scary about Donald Trump.
Now, how about those days when you feel less motivated, less energetic than others? And we'll have biorhythms. There are days we wake up and we just get ready to take on the world. Other days when we wake up and, you know, we just don't have quite the same level of energy for or passion for our lives. What do you do in that case?
Well, if you know your biorhythms, I think it's often a good idea just to honor that. You know, make it a day where you rest, or you make it a spa day, or you take some time off. Sometimes your body is telling you, hey, dude, you've been going too long. I don't know if you've ever moved and you have all these boxes of books and you're carrying them out to the moving van. And eventually your arms don't even want, they kind of like let go. There's just no strength left in them. And so sometimes your body's telling you that and you have to look in. But you also have to look, is there some emotional thing coming up? Like, we know that people who've had people die on them, you know, that are important to them, like parents and children and spouses, on the anniversary of their death, they may wake up and just feel really depressed or sad, and they don't know why at first, but they're, you know, unconsciously recalling that event. In those kind of cases, you just want to, you know, tap or do the Sedona method or something to honor those feelings, but then release them. I think feelings are important to accept, but not dwell in them, not wallow in them. And so we have all these technologies now to help us move into the greater thing. So for me, as I mentioned, I'm a big fan of Esther Hicks and Abraham, and they talk about whenever you have a negative feeling, there probably is a negative thought that's creating it. They call it a negative feeling thought, meaning a thought that creates a negative feeling. And so I will meditate and pay attention to what my thoughts are. And then if I see there's negative limiting thoughts, fear, feeling overwhelmed, not wanting to go to work, whatever, I will replace that with a positive thought. And then I will visualize the positive outcome. If I need to tap on it, I will. And then there are other things you can do. Positive music, you know, sometimes just getting up and moving. You know, the motions, the word emotion means energy, E, in motion, energy that moves through you. It's only when it gets stuck that there's a problem. So by moving our body through dance, through yoga, through Tai Chi, through a number of different techniques, Qigong, etc., you can move that energy so it starts to move. And if you listen to music with uplifting lyrics, which I have, you know, many tracks that I put on different playlists, you know, with uplifting music by John Denver and James Taylor and so forth, then that gets my head, my mindset into a positive space as well. If I really get down, I will call somebody that is like, I have a couple mentors that I reach out to, like Stuart Emery, Stephen Josephs, and I'll say, hey, I need some help. And then, you know, maybe something's bigger than I can deal with because I'm too caught up in it. So a lot of options. You know, one of my friends actually hangs in his bathroom, he calls it an anti-depression list. And it's just a laminated piece of paper. All the things that if he does them, gets him out of a state of being down. All the kind of things I just mentioned, go for a walk, go for a run, listen to music, watch a comedy movie, etc. So that if he finds himself in that space when he's not thinking, there's something there that he's put in his environment to remind him that he has options.
And it takes some deliberation to do that. He had to compile that list, he had to laminate that list, he had to put it in a place where he could find it easily. And so just taking some kind of action like that is really powerful. And when you do that, you're replacing the negative contents of your head with the positive input from that music, from that inspirational speaker, from some external source. And, you know, you mentioned Abraham Hicks. I love listening to those CDs in the car, because rather than my own thoughts just rattling around wherever they might be, then I'm filling my mind with this really high energy positive stuff.
Right, absolutely.
And you can plan your day that way, plan your week that way, plan your year that way, with a supply of this positive material. Here in our office, we have actually have a big bag of those Abraham tapes. And whenever somebody's like, struggling or has a lot of negative self-chatter, we'll just grab a handful of those and say, here, put these in the CD rather than whatever's going on in your head right now.
Yeah, that's really good. It's a good metaphor to kind of imagine your head as a CD player. And if what you're getting is negative stuff, just change the CD. And I write about something called the law of replacement, that it's difficult to stop a thought. It's easy to replace a thought.
Interesting. So you can't stop yourself thinking at all, but what you can do is replace one thought with another thought. And if you, I know you talk about in the book as well about premeditating that process. You actually have a thought that you plan to use that day in advance so that when those negative thoughts come up, you have the positive thought prepared already to
yes.
put in there.
Yeah, it's like a replacement thought that you know if you need it, it's already there. Because often when you're in that state, you don't have the capacity to think deeply. But if you've already said, okay, if this shows up, I'm going to think this thought. I'm a worthwhile person and I deserve to be loved or something like that. And that becomes your mantra for the day if you need it.
We'll have a written PDF that goes along with the transcript of this talk, Jack, and I'll make sure that we have a whole bunch of those ideas, those practical steps you can take in that way to implement these in your life, because it's so important, again, that people hear this, get inspired, but then immediately take that practical action to have that list, have that thought, have that music, have that mentor, have something they can actually do and then do consistently until they form new habits, not just a few new items that they try.
Yeah, and that's important, too, that what you're saying is that over time, when you have a repetition, like whether it's the Abraham tapes or listening to a CD by me or Tony Robbins or you or whatever, what happens is over time, those neural pathways get thicker and thicker as the dendrites, spiny protuberances get thicker, as you know. What happens is then your thoughts more likely go down that groove than the old groove. But it takes discipline. It takes intention. You know, if change were easy, we'd all be thin and wealthy and have great relationships. And the truth is, most of us don't.
When you are at the stage you're at now, you also have the job of managing money. So I know that as you start to make money, that the focus starts from moves from accumulating money to managing money. Has that been a shift for you in your mindset?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I in the beginning only made enough money to live on. And then when I met W. Clement Stone, he said, you have to put away 20% of your income, and gave me the book, The Richest Man in Babylon, to read. And since then, there have been books like The Automatic Millionaire by David Bach and so forth that teach this idea. And if you put away a percentage of your income and then they reinvest the interest off that, and you do that for 20, 30, 40 years, you become an automatic millionaire. And so I started to do that. And it was difficult because when you're young, when I was young at least, you know, I wanted to buy the new suit, the new pen, the new car, whatever it was. And it was difficult to do that. But I did it. And then after you got a certain amount, then it's called like, well, what do I invest it in? Do I invest it in real estate? Do I invest it in stocks? Do I invest it in bonds? How do I know which ones? And quite frankly, money's not a big driver for me. I don't like to keep my books. I don't like to balance my checkbook. I don't really think much about it other than I figured out how much money will I need when I retire to live the lifestyle I want. So I've been accumulating money over time. I don't really ever plan to retire. But if for any reason, like, you know, I'm 70 now, I'll be 70 in August in a month. And so what happens is that I do pay attention to that. But what happened for me was I began to realize there are people who are passionate about this. And so I need to find friends and trusted advisors in the arenas that I don't care much about, but I need to know about. So in terms of health and nutrition and fitness, I have advisors that do the research, and I've learned to trust them. So if they say, eat this, don't eat that, take these vitamins, don't take those, I listen. And the same with money. So right now I have someone who advises me very carefully about all that, and I just 99% of the time I do what they say. The one time I didn't, as I wanted to buy a lot of Apple stock, and he didn't, and I said, I'm doing it anyway, and it tripled. So occasionally you have to trust your intuition.
Now that comes to the whole areas of our lives that we excel in and do easily, and areas that we we struggle with and or are less interested in. And so what you're saying is that you can focus on your strengths, you can delegate areas that you don't necessarily want to be knee-deep in, and that is a formula that really works for you.
Yes, I'm a big believer in building on your strengths. I mean, I think certain weaknesses have to be addressed. If you don't listen to people, if all your friends think you're an asshole kind of thing, then obviously there's some behaviors you're doing that are alienating people that you don't want to alienate. So there's some feedback about change where you need to deal with it. But there's a lot of things that I just don't have a deep interest in. Like I don't really like to run my company. But I've got a staff person who loves to run the company. I've got an office manager. I have a president of the company. I've got people who do PR and marketing and sales, which don't interest me that much. Some people love it. They build their whole careers around it, like internet marketing experts. But for me, what really turns me on, what my core genius is, and I think everybody has a core genius, something you do so well that you don't even realize how valuable it is, and you probably undercharge for it, that is fun to do. And you can do in your sleep because it's just your natural beingness. And for me, it's teaching, training, coaching, writing, editing, those kind of things. And that's where I spend the majority of my time. And then I check up on things because I still am the CEO of the company. But basically, I don't want to spend my time doing things that contract me rather than expand me, to go back to an earlier part of what we talked about.
And then when you've got that creative team around you, how do you spark them all expressing their full potential and then meshing well with you and with each other?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really important how you pick your team. I remember talking to the people at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel and how they pick, because they have the greatest staff. And they said, we pick people who are energetic, alive, relate well to others, are outgoing, are generous, kind, etc. We can teach them the hotel business. But if I had to get someone who knows the hotel business, but they don't like people, you know, that's much harder to change. And so almost all of my staff started out as interns from the university nearby, with a few exceptions. And basically, we got to field test them for, you know, a semester or two. And then when they graduated, we hired them. So part of it's like hire people that you really feel simpatico with. And I don't hire anyone now that my whole staff doesn't interview. So the whole staff says, this is the person we want. Reminds me of a joke I just read. And I'll come back to this. I don't know why it jumped in my head. I'll tell it. Sky is going to get married. And he says to his mom, I'm going to bring home three women. I want to see if you can tell which one's the one I'm going to marry. So he brings three beautiful women home. And his mother says, at the end of it, they spent the evening together. He says to his mom, do you know which one I'm going to marry? She says, yeah, the redhead. He said, how'd you know? He said, she's the one I don't like. So basically, you have to pick people that you feel you can get along with and your staff can get along with. Now, I'm a big fan of Tony Hsieh, who started Zappos and wrote a book called Delivering Happiness. And he talks about what keeps people engaged in their work. He talked about four things. They have a sense of control. They perceive control over their job. Like at Zappos, if you're a person taking orders, you're a customer service person, you could get on the phone and talk for 3 hours to someone, and they're fine with that. They're not, you know, with a clock, you know, timing you going, you should have done seven more orders. In fact, there's a record call that went 10 hours with someone. And so the sense of control, I don't micromanage my staff. I tell them what the parameters are. These are the things we need to achieve. And I let them go do it. Second thing is a sense of progress. Do they feel like they're making progress in their career, in their life, in their personal growth, financially, etc.? And so we make sure that everyone's involved in getting good feedback and being able to take trainings that matter to them, and you know, being able to report to us what they're doing, and you know, be held accountable and so forth. Connectedness is the third thing. Our staff all likes each other. They get along. In fact, after this call, I'll be going to a birthday luncheon at the country club. And we do that every month. We have a birthday party for anyone who had birthdays that month. We all get together. We have a lot of fun. We have pool parties at my pool at my house. We've had margarita tastings. And, you know, we just have a lot of fun together. And so they want to feel connected to each other. And then finally, and I will say this too, because we're a personal growth company, they feel connected to our clients, to the people that we work with, because they go to the seminars I lead. They become friends with people. I mean, one of my staff last year went to Europe, visited 4 countries, never paid for a meal or a room because we have graduates in those countries that they'd all become friends with. So they get this great sense of connectedness around the world. And the last thing is a meaningful commitment to something bigger than themselves. So we have a goal to train 1 million people by the year 2030 to do this work in some way, whether it's teach it in a classroom in school or teach it in a workshop out in the general public or to do teleseminars like this, etc. And so everyone feels like they're making a huge difference in the world. And finally, we do something we call profit sharing. I take 15% of the gross profits of the company and we divide that up among people. We have a formula about how many years you've been here, along with what you accomplished that year. Did you do anything outstanding, et cetera? So, you know, people, my receptionist could get a $75,000 bonus. And so there's a real, nobody's leaving here. they're not going anywhere. And they get 6 weeks off vacation every year, usually longer than that. But they get 6 weeks plus usually Christmas and Easter and those kind of things. So there's a tremendous sense of this is a fun place to work.
Yeah. And once you've been able to spark that and then continue it so it becomes institutionalized, it just is the way you work, then you're in the middle of this creative cauldron in right. which all kinds of new and fun things can happen.
And we also have a director of WOW. One of the things that we came upon was this guy, excuse me, who runs High Point University, Nito Cubain, who at the university has the director of WOW. And his only job is to make sure that the students, the parents, and the faculty are constantly going, WOW. Like one of the things they do on campus there is on a hot day, they have an ice cream truck that gives out free ice cream. Or they have a truck that gives out free cold water bottles as students are walking across campus. If you're a girl and you park your car after 10 o'clock, it's valet parked so you don't have to run the risk of going from the parking lot to your dorm and getting raped. So they have, those are just like one of 100 things. So when we found out about that, I said, wow, we're going to have a director of WOW. How can we have our clients have more of a WOW experience? Right now, for instance, if someone signs up for one of our luxury retreats, I do a video email to them saying, hey, welcome to the thing. And I talk about things that are in their application and let them know that I've really spent time thinking about them just from their application form. And we're really looking forward to seeing them. They go, wow, I wasn't expecting that. When they show up, we give them 3 presents the first night. They go, wow. So how can we continually outperform and surpass people's expectations in a way that gives them a thrill?
And keeps it fun for you as well.
Yes.
So, Jack, what is your leading edge? What new thing do you sense gestating in you?
I don't know for sure right now. I'm finishing up a revision of the Success Principles book, which will come out in January of 2015. I'm working on a book that will be due in November called The 30-Day Sobriety Solution, where we're looking at all of how do we integrate all of the work that's been done in the human potential movement with the traditional rehabilitation programs, because a lot of it's not there. And so we're saying you can get sober in the privacy of your own home if you go through these 30 solutions, this 30-day program we have. And I'm working with a guy who's already doing that online with people and getting an 85% recovery rate, whereas AA sometimes as low as 20%. So that's interesting to me because I have several family members who've struggled with alcoholism and drug addiction. And it doesn't feel like a cutting edge, but it feels like something really important to me. And then finally, we're training trainers. And that's exciting because I'm getting better at it every year. We've been doing it now for the last 5 years. And we've trained about 600 people around the world to do this work in real depth. And every year I understand how to do it faster and better. On a personal level, there's a guy named Deepak who lives here in town. I can't even remember his last name right now. My wife's seeing him. And he's doing this work where as you talk about your life, he has a computer that's listening to the tones that are in your voice. And there are certain tones that don't show up in the spectrum that should be there. And based on that, he then inputs those tones into you through music and vibration, and you get better. And my wife's having these miraculous healings occur. And so I'm going to go do that as for me. So that's exciting. And finally, I would just say playing bigger. I would like to have even a bigger impact in the world. So like I'm going to a conference this weekend where the people that give out the X Prize, Peter Diamandis, they have a visioneering retreat where 200 people come and they talk about what prize should be given out to solve what problem. And so I'm going to be there with 200 of the smartest people in America coming up with solutions for the world. So that's kind of exciting for me.
Yeah, the way you've been able to create a peer group in the Transformational Leadership Council and been able to create other peer groups as well is really a fabulous service to people, because then they're able to spark each other, inspire each other. And when you get a whole bunch of inspired people in the room, then miracles happen. One of your success principles is to have this humorous thing of leave the Ain't It Awful Club. And
yes,
just surrounding yourself with people who inspire you, who nurture you, who challenge you is such a powerful step in shifting the way you function at your own baseline.
Yeah, well, I teach that you become the average of the five people you spend the most time with. So I'm constantly trying to get myself around people who are creative, loving, you know, committed to making a difference in the world, and hopefully are a little bit ahead of me in some areas so that I can learn something from them. And that's the people I love to be with, you know, yourself included. So basically, for me, I started the Transformational Leadership Council because I didn't have a peer group. There was no association that existed of people who do the kind of work we do. There might be an EFT or an energy conference or a Gestalt conference, but there wasn't a overall transformational conference. And so that was a big, you know, you going back to, it was something scary. I put off those calls for a year, Dawson. I thought, why would people want to come be with me? You know, I had that low self-esteem kind of thing going on there. And I invited 30 people to my home, and 29 of them came. Actually, I invited 31, 30 came, and 29 of them decided to start it with me. And so that totally shifted my sense of who I was in the world. So that fear disappeared. But again, it was stepping through the fear that allowed that to happen. So I always say to people, if you want to become a leader in your community, start an organization where you invite other leaders to join. There's a doctor in my town, Dr. Jim Kwako, which is a terrible name for a doctor to have, like Kwako. But he's an amazing being. He's a holistic practitioner. And he started this called Holistic Healing Group of doctors and chiropractors and Rolfers and energy healers. And we meet the first Friday of every month at a lunch that is put on at the local restaurant. And it's very informal and very cool. And what happens is that we get to hang out with a teacher that's going to teach us something that Friday. And he's become, excuse me for that, hold on a second, let me get rid of that call. And he has literally evolved as a leader in our community simply because he asked other people, and all he does is kind of put it together. Now he's considered one of the top doctors in town. He was always one, but he was under the radar. So if you want to get up above the radar, do like you're doing. You're leading, you know, the EFT website. You're putting on this telesummit. And by doing that, you establish yourself as a leader of leaders. And so it's a great technique for anybody, whether it's real estate, you know, people that are massage therapists, whatever. You put together the group that meets and shares, and you've expanded your own capacity, and you get to learn a lot, as you and I get to do when we go to TLC.
And I so love the way you bring play into this, Jack. You yourself are playful and smiling, and you have play as part of TLC. So it's not just a conference; it's also a time to get together and have fun. And you bring this sense of being a 70-year-old child at play into your world and mine. And I so deeply appreciate that part of you.
Thank you. No, I love to play. You're right. I'm irreverent, and I love to play. If you remember, we had a build a raft and race it contest at our last TLC meeting. I think that was some of the three funnest hours of my life. I really enjoyed getting into that kind of play.
The rickety raft contest.
Yes, that's what it was. A lot of fun.
Well, Jack, I can't wait for the new edition of the book to come out, and I'll make sure I mention it to everyone I know. And again, we'll make sure there's a lot of resources attached to the interview that people can use to find you and find these techniques. And again, thank you for your greatness of heart, your breadth of mind, your generosity of spirit, and the way you've shared yourself and your world so freely today. I just feel grateful to be your friend and to receive this and share it with many other people. So thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Well, I feel grateful for the opportunity, and at the risk of being self-serving, I just want to mention my website, which is www.jackcanfield.com. And if anyone got turned on by any of these ideas and wants to pursue it further with me, that's where you would go. And again, I really appreciate the opportunity, Dawson, to speak to your community.
Bless you, Jack. Thank you again.
Okay, take care, buddy.
Okay. Well, an amazing interview with Jack. And again, we will have an upgrade package available, and I strongly encourage you to check that out, especially all of the exercises Jack mentions. He is a consummate teacher of practical techniques to implement these things in your life right now. So I hope you were inspired. However, I'd like you to take practical action, grab the upgrade, and then apply these exercises in your life starting today. Don't delay. Don't let it go. Don't say you'll do it at a subsequent time. Make sure that now you're fresh, now that you've felt the energy that you can unleash with these things. Go ahead and act on those, grab the upgrade, and start to practice those exercises in your life today.